The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're talking with the irrepressible designer Isaac Mizrahi about his key three, his three essential recipes.
One is Jacques Pepin's chocolate souffle recipe, which is flawless. And then Alex Garnaschelli's sort of yellow and red tomato sauce, because it's so easy and it's so incredibly delicious. And then the third one I picked is a vinaigrette, which, who authored the vinaigrette recipe? Nobody, right? I mean, this is the way my mom used to make vinaigrette, and it's kind of like the best way to make vinaigrette in a jar.
Stay with us. Lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, we're starting out with another installment of our Key Three. That's our project that takes us into the kitchens of the most interesting cooks we know and asks them what are their three essential recipes. Well, this week, our Key Three pick is Isaac Mizrahi. Isaac is the much-awarded international designer, judge on Project Runway All-Stars, and the man who started cooking at 11 years old when he fell in love with the word sauté. It's not easy to describe Isaac. He's so intensely engaged in everything that he does. He's a self-taught cook who doesn't waste time. He goes directly to the masters, and he has this critic's eye for whose recipes to trust and not to trust. Well, Isaac invited us up to his offices where he designs, films, and cooks. His kitchen is white, wide open to the rest of the loft and streamlined. But there's a big crystal chandelier over the island, an Isaac touch if there ever was one. And that's where we settled in. Isaac, this is just a treat. We are here in this studio that you have.
That's right.
Yeah, this place. You do a show from here.
It's a one-stop shopping because I have all of my design studio in the other room. As you've noticed, there's like millions of designers who I work with.
Right.
Inches. And then in here, it's our kind of studio where we tape things like our, we have like a website and we do, you know, all those kind of segments. And we also tape sometimes our QVC show from here.
And you have a full kitchen here.
That's right. We do. It's actually not a bad kitchen, I have to say.
I have to say, yeah, it's all white.
Right.
We're sitting at an island and we've got a pile of jars and
yes, we
we've got veggies and whatever. Okay, so key three recipes for you.
All right, well, you know, key three, that's a really hard thing. You know, when you ask me what are my most kind of guarded favorite recipes that work in millions of different ways, right? That's part of it.
Exactly.
Like a workhorse kind of recipe. One is Jacques Pepin's chocolate souffle recipe, which is flawless. It's such a flawless recipe. I picked Alex Garnaschelli's sort of yellow and red tomato sauce because it's so easy and it's so incredibly delicious. And then the third one I picked is a vinaigrette, which I don't even think anybody, who authored the vinaigrette recipe? Nobody, right? I mean, this is the way my mom used to make vinaigrette, and it's kind of like the best way to make vinaigrette in a jar.
You can do anything with it.
You can do anything with any three of those recipes. Like that tomato sauce is really versatile. That souffle, you can do endless amounts of sauces and add things to it. And this vinaigrette, my dear, you could put almost anything in it. It could be really delicious.
So you're going to show me how to make the vinaigrette?
Should
now,
I
how
do
you
it?
Do the vinaigrette?
I will, yes. I'll give you the basic idea. I'm going to start by mincing some garlic. Now, to be honest, I would press it, but you know you're not supposed to because it makes it a little bitter when you press it. So those of us who like are snobs about things, which I'm not, but at least for radio shows, I am kind of, right? I'm gonna just, you know, mince
Don't
a little
Don't be
garlic.
Intimidated.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Now, the other thing about garlic when you add it to a vinaigrette is you have to be careful because if you add too much, it gets It's just not right, is it?
It's too much.
It's like garlic toast when you put too much garlic on the toast. And it's like, I don't know how much you think. That much?
But that's a good-sized clove. So you're doing about half of it?
About half a good-sized clove. Okay. Right? And here we are chopping away. Notice I have such wonderful knife skills. Okay?
You really do, though.
I'm kidding. Okay, that was a joke.
I'm not kidding. You are doing paper-thin slices.
I'm trying to mince it. I don't have good leverage here. But all right, so you're mince. Let's pretend that's really well minced.
Okay.
By the way, if you were Jacques, you'd smash it a little bit and mince it, make it into a paste, you know, the way they do.
Right.
And we can if we want, right? We can.
But this is radio, so nobody can see what you're
doing. Exactly.
Okay.
All right, so let's say that's finely minced and you put it in a jar. Then olive oil, right? A good olive oil.
Okay.
And there was that olive oil scandal where, like, you know, some of it was really, like, you know, turpentine.
Made in Italy. Yes.
Labels.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you read that in The New Yorker a few years ago?
Yeah, and now he's done a book called Extra Virginity.
Right.
Yes.
I'm very paranoid about my brands of olive oil since reading that article.
Yeah, take a look at the book. There's some interesting information.
All right, what is this, like 2 tablespoons, let's say, for an average salad? You say when 2 tablespoons, when?
About 2 tablespoons.
Okay, that's 2 tablespoons.
You've got it.
Right?
Yeah.
And then one part vinegar. So, I mean, you could use any vinegar in the world.
You've got quite a selection.
I know. What do you like?
Well, you've got the sherry vinegar, you've got balsamic, mm-hmm. you've got rice vinegar, and you've got a special wine vinegar, dry and crisp white wine vinegar. You know, I'd go with the sherry vinegar.
Okay, I agree. That's classic, right?
Yeah.
Speaking of Julia Child, like 1970s or whatever.
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah.
Now, this we have to just be careful, okay?
Yeah.
And I would put like 2 parts to 1 part and not
so
even.
2 parts olive oil, 1 part vinegar.
Yeah, and a little less vinegar, right?
Right.
A little less than 1 part.
It's really how you like it, right?
That's right, absolutely. Okay, so there's that. And then this is salt, right? I like it very salty, I have to say. I like to salt the vinaigrette a lot.
2-3 pinches of salt?
Right?
Okay.
Very good pinches, and I like a lot of pepper in there because I don't like to salt and pepper the salad itself. I like to use it in the vinaigrette.
Do you know this is considered by the French to be one of the 5 mother sauces?
Yes. It's really true, right? Because you can do anything with this. If you chopped herbs and put that in there, it'd be delicious. If you put a little bit of mayonnaise, whether you make it yourself or it's Hellman's or something, delicious. If you put a little white wine in there, it's delicious, right? What else? Horseradish. And I'm going to use mustard in this. Not a whole lot of mustard. Like what? Like about a teaspoon of mustard, right?
Okay.
Is that about a teaspoon? Because otherwise all you taste is mustard. Okay, so there's that. I mean, that's basic. There's oil, vinegar, right?
Right.
Salt, pepper, and the mustard, which helps, right? It just helps the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I mean, if I had a little white wine, dry white wine,
I would use it
just because I like the way it makes it less thick. It's not so viscous. Do you know what I mean? And it's easier to toss the salad, and it's delicious. But
what happens next?
Well, then, here's the thing. Like, you know people who make it in bowls and whisk it for hours?
Yeah.
Could you tell me why they do that, please?
Well, they do it to emulsify it
Yeah, but get this. That's emulsification. Better than you can ever...
I'm just shaking it. Yeah, you're shaking it like...
I have to tell you, this is rather a large jar. I like a smaller jar. I'll tell you what the best jar in the world is. Because this is like a pickling jar.
Right, it's a ball jar.
Yeah, and it has like a separate...
Lid on it. And, that comes apart.
But I like the Hellman's mayonnaise, like mini. I swear I just buy them so I can empty them out and use the jars for vinaigrettes because it's so perfect. It's the right size and it has this kind of plastic top that isn't 2 parts and you can wash it. It's fantastic. I love it. Okay, so now this is the vinaigrette and I bet it's delicious. Now, can I just tell you a little tiny secret?
Sure.
My little secret about this? You know what I always do is just a little pinch of sugar. And that's cheating, I think, because you're supposed to be able to get the proportions right, but this corrects in this crazy way. If you wanted a little lemon in there, good.
Right,
but I always find lemon really hard to work with. I don't know why. Because you always just taste the lemon.
It takes over.
It really, really does to me.
There's a theory that sugar blends, little bits of sugar that you don't really taste, but that it blends flavors.
Does it? Well, that's what it does.
I don't know how,
but whenever I leave the sugar out, I can always go like, oh, that's bitter. Oh, that's too lemony. Oh, that's too much vinegar. Oh, something's wrong with it. And the minute I just add that magic little teeny dram of sugar, it really does a trick. I'm telling you, it's funny. Oh, you want to taste it?
Yeah, can we taste it?
Let's taste it,
yes. Can we taste it?
Should we taste it on the lettuce?
I think that would be fabulous.
All right, do we have there's a little tong. Should I just dress this? Because this seems like the right amount.
Absolutely.
This is what? This is just a little butter lettuce, right?
Right, a little butter lettuce. And here are the tongs.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean, you're going to go like, oh, yeah, right, that's just vinaigrette. But if you wanted to do, let's see, like a little horseradish would be delicious. I don't know why I didn't, but I didn't. Because I like the idea of just a classic recipe that can be taken away, you know? All right.
It smells absolutely marvelous.
I'm going to try a little some myself. Just before you try it, I better try it. Or you tell me.
I'll be your tester.
Oh. I mean, how do you...
The vinegar comes through.
Wow. There is a little too much of it on the salad, but you see it's delicious, right?
It sets off the salad, though.
Mm-hmm.
It really sets off the salad, and you can taste the vinegar, and you can taste the mustard.
Yeah.
You get all the elements.
I mean,
I don't taste the sugar at all.
No, you don't. And the thing is, it's sharp tasting, right? It's sharp,
yeah, but, it
but it's not annoyingly sharp. Like, you want to keep eating this.
Isaac, if you ever decide to give up on the clothes... There's a future here. There's a future here. Isaac, thank you.
Thank you. You're the best.
Isaac Mizrahi judges Project Runway All-Stars. Now, you can see Isaac and his designs every Monday on QVC. Now, to find his vinaigrette recipe and hear all about the other two of his key three dishes, they're an unusual tomato sauce and a dead simple chocolate souffle, go to the website, splendidtable.org. When Jane and Michael Stern piled into a VW bus with a fold-up map of the United States, they were probably certifiably nuts. You see, they had this plan. It was the 70s, they were naive Easterners, and the plan was that summer, they'd critique every local cafe in America. Now that was crazy, but it did lead to their lifelong careers and eventually to their site, roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Hey, Len.
Hi, Len. So where have you been?
We have been in New Mexico. We love New Mexico. It's a beautiful state. It really is the land of enchantment. And if you like interesting food, it's a fabulous place. You know, New Mexico is one of the states in this country, one of the very few, that really has a culinary identity that it loves and treasures. I mean, there really is a New Mexican cuisine like few states have.
And it's all based on the chili pepper.
Of course.
How would you describe it?
New Mexican food is very earthy. It's extremely spicy. You know, in a New Mexican restaurant, in many New Mexican restaurants, when they ask you if you want your food medium or hot.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're a seasoned hot food eater, you definitely want medium because their medium is my idea of pretty darn hot.
Let me tell you how we got there. You know, usually Michael and I travel alone together. A couple of months ago, we did our annual road food tour where Michael and I and our partner, Stephen Rushmore, and 55 of our closest road food friends. And we decided we would take them in a bus to Santa Fe and show them the wonders of New Mexican cuisine. Now, that was all well and good, but the greatest moment was we went to Mesilla, New Mexico.
Which is far south. I mean, this is in the Rio Grande Valley down there where they grow the chili peppers.
And we went to a restaurant that's been there for 70 years called La Posta. After we had spent the afternoon at the New Mexico State University learning all about chili peppers, and then here was the ultimate food made from chilies.
Jerrine Hutchinson, who runs the place, whose grandmother opened it as a four-table chili parlor 70 years ago, she made a big point of saying in her kitchen – there is no such thing as chili powder. Everything they make from chilies is made from the chili peppers themselves. They use no pre-made powder whatsoever.
So what do you order there? Carne adobada, I think if you had one dish, which is like a Mexican pot roast that has been—
made with pork.
Right. Simmered forever in red chili sauce.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's fork tender.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's wouldn't you say that's the classic New Mexican—
That's the classic New Mexican dish. La Posta also invented a dish called tostada compuesta, which is – it's sort of cornmeal. It's a cornmeal – I want to call it like a deconstructed taco, but it's it's hard to describe. It's a knife and fork thing that they invented there, you know, decades ago, and it's, that's sort of their signature dish. But you cannot go to La Posta without getting carne adobada and at least one chili relleno.
Oh, and also the best puffy sopapillas I've ever had. And the ride from Santa Fe or from anywhere to Mesilla, which is, I believe that's where Billy the Kid
did his incarcerated there at one point.
Yeah, it's very historic, old New Mexico, is breathtaking and really out in the middle of nowhere. It's quite a wonderful place to go.
Yep.
Okay, we're there.
Let's eat.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the minds behind roadfood.com. Find their eating picks on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, you can get a lot done on our website. Browse our recipe box, download podcasts, and get registered for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And by the way, this is our 20th year of broadcasting. We'll be celebrating all year with special collections and opportunities. So be sure to sign up for the newsletter. That way we can keep you up to date with our 20th anniversary offerings. That's Weeknight Kitchen at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the delicious and sturdy wines of Madeira. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Whatever happened to Madeira? I mean, talk about a forgotten gem of a wine. Overlooked, maybe underpriced. Why is it not touted and talked about? I do not know. But wine critic Patrick Kaminsky is just back from a trip to the island of Madeira. Now, Patrick writes for Wine and Spirits magazine. Patrick, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you. I did just get back from Madeira. It is one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen.
Where is Madeira?
Madeira is an archipelago about 350 miles west of Morocco. It is part of the country of Portugal, so there is an established Portuguese culture there, but it really is a place unto itself. It's one of the most vertically challenged wine regions I've ever seen. It is so dramatically mountainous. I've never seen a place quite like it outside of Bali or perhaps Hawaii.
You know, Patrick, a lot of people have not tasted Madeira. So can you explain what it is?
Sure. Madeira is a fortified wine. It's made with red or white grapes, but mostly red grapes. But color isn't really something that comes into play because the wine is deliberately oxidized and heated so that it always has a kind of amber or tawny color. It is a sweet wine, but the levels of sweetness change from wine to wine. You can have a dry Madeira, which is just mildly, has a touch of sweetness, or you can have a sweet Madeira, which is, in fact, quite rich and sweet. It always has a wonderfully caramelly, nutty flavor, no matter whether it's a young wine or a very old wine. And as we'll see, the wines can get quite old. In younger wines, you get aromas of caramel, of maple sugar, of honey, and sometimes molasses. Usually the fruit is something sort of candied, like candied ginger or candied orange. Candied maraschino cherry even is not uncommon. There's always some wonderful warm baking spice component to the younger wines. You get hints of five spice powder, nutmeg, and cinnamon. Most Madeiras are made with a grape known as Tinta Negra, though traditional Madeiras, the Madeiras that have been revered throughout history, are mostly made with white grapes. Those are in the minority now because those grapes are much more difficult to grow. However, they are still very much in the market, and I will go ahead and name the rest of them. These run from driest to sweetest, roughly. Sercial is the driest. Verdejo is the next dry and perhaps the most versatile because it sort of straddles between dry and sweet.
Right.
And then the two richest wines are Boal and Malmsey or Malvasia.
So you go from you can go from something that's quite dry that you might drink at the beginning of a meal or even with food?
Absolutely with food. The drier wines are very, very wonderful with savory dishes. I talked to a number of sommeliers, and one of the prevailing pairings that came through was foie gras. In fact, one sommelier that I spoke to was having what he called a foie-for-all coursed dinner. Another sommelier that I spoke to noted that the drier Madeiras are really well suited to various umami iterations, whether it's mushroom soup, whether it's something that uses a reduced chicken broth.
Mm-hmm.
Madeira is a perfect match for something that utilizes that kind of richness of flavor.
Would you serve these chilled or would you serve these at room temperature?
The younger wines are often lightly chilled, and the drier wines also respond to a little bit of chill. Other than that, room temperature is just fine. The great thing about these wines is that once they've been heat-treated through this estufage process, they are virtually unspoilable. They will not go bad. And for that reason, you can have a wine in January and try it again the following January, and you'll have essentially the same experience.
So you can't
that
kill
is them. Obviously quite rare in wine.
Yeah. Something I read that you wrote, that you said these were the wines of the original 13 colonies. I mean, we were drinking these wines all those centuries ago?
These wines were very important to colonial America. Thomas Jefferson had a huge collection. George Washington drank Madeira every night with dinner. When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, they toasted their achievement with Madeira. Betsy Ross was a tippler. John Hancock apparently imported Madeira for a time. So it is a huge part of American history and was well into the 19th century.
Are they very expensive?
The entry-level wines are remarkably inexpensive. You can get a Rainwater Madeira for less than $20, and you'll be very happy with it. However, these wines are actually aged in the wineries themselves, sometimes for hundreds of years. And
oh
so
my.
It's not surprising for you to find wines that were made in the 18th century that you can still buy. And believe me, you will pay for it. But they are some of the most remarkable wines that I've had. I have had wines going back to the 1850s, and they are extraordinary.
It's a romance for you, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. Oh, indeed.
Patrick, thank you.
Thank you.
Wine critic Patrick Kaminski writes for Wine and Spirits magazine. For more information on Madeira and a dessert to go with it, that is Jerry Traunfeld's Bay Leaf Creme Brulee, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Crescent Dragon Wagon. Now, there is a name that you'll not forget, and her food is pretty unforgettable, too. Crescent's written bean by bean, and she makes a point in the book that the bean is the most democratic of foods. A world of people eat them, no matter where they live or who they are. And besides, for gardeners, they're practically magical. Crescent, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm tickled to be here.
So why magic for gardeners?
Well, of course, magic and beans go way back to Jack and the Beanstalk. But, you know, beans are one of the only plants. I used to say the only plant, but I just read about a tree in Africa that also gives back to the soil. In other words, when you raise them, they don't deplete the soil of nutrients during their growing phase. They actually give back. They actually enrich the soil. They add nitrogen to the soil. They're also beautiful and magical in that they germinate quickly. You know, what is the first thing that a child grows in a paper cup in kindergarten? A bean, because it sprouts big, fast, dramatic, you see it. And that says nothing about their fecundity, their variety, the ways that you can cook with them. That's just a few of the things that I find magical about them.
Well, there's something you do in the book that there are a lot of bean books out there. But I've seen very few that have talked so much about green beans. Talk to me about what you do with green beans.
Well, you know, green bean, green meaning not only green the color, but green as in immature or young. Mm-hmm. So a green bean is a fresh or immature bean. And although we say green, a green bean may be yellow. It may be a yellow wax bean. They can also be purple. There's a beautiful purple one called Violetto and another one called, I think, Trifecta. The sad thing about those beautiful purple green beans is that when you bring the water to the boil and drop the purple green beans in, you can stand over the pot and watch them turn back to green as they cook. Another bean
magic.
Yeah,
I know. You hope that they're going to be purple in the final stages and they turn green. Yeah. But talk about some of the things that you do with those green beans.
Oh, yes. Well, there's one thing that I love, and there's one version that's Greek, one version that's Italian, and there's my own dragon version. I lived in the South for a long time, and although there are some recipes that I still like tender crisp in a green bean, you know, various stir fries, I have really fallen in love with slow-cooked, meltingly tender green beans. And one of my very favorites is to skim a nice heavy cast iron skillet with olive oil and have the skillet cold, not hot, and scatter quite a bit, a couple of tablespoons of chopped, not crushed, garlic over that.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, tipped and tailed green beans packed on top of that, and then dice up a tomato, sprinkle that over the top, cover it. Turn the heat on very, very, very low as you can get it, and then just kind of forget about it. And maybe check it 45 minutes later, lift the lid. If there's a lot of liquid, leave the lid off and raise the heat very slightly. But you might even need to leave it there longer. You want the beans to get meltingly, meltingly tender. At no point does the garlic burn. But after a while, the beans kind of caramelize in this garlic and olive oil and tomato, if we wanted to be fancy, we could say confit, or just a jam of that and their own juices. And, you know, 45 minutes is the minimum. You might even do an hour, hour and 15 minutes. And at the end, they don't look very pretty. They look a little shriveled-y and browned on the edge, and you kind of go, huh? And I season them at the end. I do a little coarse salt, black pepper. This is one of the few things that I like a little bit of dried dill on, not fresh. Fresh is too dominant a flavor. Tiny bit of dried dill and, the kicker, a few shakes of cayenne.
Mm.
And you very gently turn it so you don't break those beans up. And they are so good. And they're so good that once I served them at the inn, and a man made me a proposal of marriage on the basis of my green beans.
Crescent sounds delicious. Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Crescent Dragon Wagon's latest book is Bean by Bean. Try those melting beans that she talked about. The recipe is Greek-style green beans, and it is on the website, splendidtable.org.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said, look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We're talking with you. Call us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's get going. We've got
Hannah on the line from Texas. Hannah, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you so much for taking this call.
You are welcome.
I am getting married in May.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And instead of doing a cake, I wanted to bake pies. But I have about 100 people coming.
Uh-huh.
So I think I'm going to need about 12 to 15 pies. And rather than make them all the night before my wedding, which I think would not be a good choice.
I think that would be a real experience in insanity. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if I could start it and make a couple pies a week.
Well, you could. I mean, you could, because basically what you want to do is you can freeze a lot. Fruit pies and that kind of thing, you can freeze in advance. But there is a trick.
Okay.
All right. When you know how fruit pies throw off a lot of liquid?
Yeah.
Well, one of the tricks is that when you mix the filling for a fruit pie, which is usually sugar with the fruit,
mm-hmm.
you put it in a strainer and you put that strainer over a bowl and you forget about it for about a half hour or more.
Oh.
So what you're doing is you're letting the sugar extract as much moisture as possible from that fruit.
Okay.
So that that's not going to happen while it's in the oven and make for a sloppy crust.
Okay.
Okay. Now what you do is you take all of that moisture mm-hmm. that's in the bottom of the bowl, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you boil that down to a syrup. So you don't lose any of that flavor. It really is sticky syrup. Put that back with the fruit. And then what you do is that's going to go into your pie. And then you can do a double crusted pie and you can freeze the whole thing. And then you can bake it off frozen. Now, I would double check. I would double check the timing of this.
Okay,
with a good cookbook. Now, one of the best books I know on baking pies is by Rose Levy Barenbaum. I think it's called The Pie Bible.
Oh.
And she is the most meticulous baker you could imagine.
Good.
Yeah, she's really – if you're into pies, I would really get the book. It's worth the investment because she'll tell you – she's a, you know, she's the person who writes two ways. She writes for the home baker and she writes for someone who may want to start a business.
Yeah.
So she's going to tell you, you can freeze this baby and you can't freeze that baby. Like, for instance, cream pies you can't freeze.
That is one thing that I'd heard.
Right. And fruit pies you can freeze. But
– you're recommending I freeze them unbaked.
Unbaked. But you may be able to freeze them baked as well. I've frozen both ways. The other thing is I always pre-bake the bottom crust, even if it's a two-crusted pie.
Oh.
I lightly pre-bake it so that that way it's crisp anyway.
Yeah, it doesn't get all
right.
Soggy.
So the point is, get a hold of Rose's book, The Pie Bible.
Okay.
And this is her trick, by the way. This is her trick, this draining of the fruit. I thought it was just brilliant. So that will be your Bible for doing your wedding. But please, oh, Hannah, get help, girl.
Thank you so much.
This is from a woman who did her own wedding also.
Oh, really? Okay, good.
Okay?
Good.
All right. And congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
We're going to be back with more of your calls in a moment. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We are talking with you. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Okay, back to your questions. Kent's calling from Nashville. Kent, hi, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
I am doing swell. How about you?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you so much. I am a huge fan of making quite a few dishes that I've noticed all have one thing in common, and that is pork shoulder. And I love to make carnitas. I'm being from Memphis originally, I'm a huge fan of a good smoky pork shoulder. And so I've sort of been working up this idea in my brain for quite some time, and it seems like it should work really well, but I wanted to run the gist of it by you and see if you can tell me where pitfalls might be or if you think it would work.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready.
Basically, the idea was, if I were to do if normally carnitas, it's essentially just sort of a confit, a kind of an approach.
Yeah, you cook and cook and cook the pork shoulder.
Right.
Until it's almost falling apart, right?
Indeed. You just do it in lard and just very low and slow. And typically what you do once after you've cooked it for quite some time, then you bring the lard up in temperature so that you crisp everything up.
Yeah.
Well, as opposed to doing that, I thought, well, what if I were to take it about maybe two-thirds of the way and basically just sort of a confit method and then take that out instead of breaking it up like you normally would and crisping it.
Mm-hmm.
Then take it to the smoker and smoke it for a few hours. I figure it's going to be awfully, awfully tender, so I would think it would hold up and not dry out too much. And then after smoking it, take it and create sort of a more of a rub than a glaze, but sort of an ancho chili powder, chipotle chili powder, cumin, honey, sea salt, little vinegar.
Right, right. Okay, so essentially, yeah, a glaze, a sauce. Yeah.
Exactly. And then throw it on a grill. Chop it into pieces, throw it on a grill really briefly, just a couple minutes.
Right.
Take all that fat and everything else and get it incredibly crispy on the outside with this glaze. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's an excellent idea. And the idea of a confit, which is where you actually cook something in its own fat.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people first might rub it with some kind of seasoning. And, you know, and with doing that with a pork shoulder already has a lot of great marbling. So that means moisture is on your side with this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the key is going to be cook it in the lard long enough for it to be just about cooked through, but that it still can hold its shape. Because in that long smoking, which is going to be low temperature but constant, it's going to continue to cook. And you don't want it to cook to the point where the meat no longer has taste or where it's totally falling apart. It still has to hold together. So the key is, essentially, it's almost like trying to maintain an interior temperature of about 160 of the chunks of meat.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of first cooking it in the lard, and if I were you, you season your lard, and I mean it's cooking in something
right.
with a right. I would leave it in the fridge overnight in that after that first step because it's going to absorb all of that flavor. Then the next, and this gives you leeway, the next day you can do the smoking. And if you want, the next day is when you finish it off, which means if you're having people over or whatever, that's when you glaze it and do that number on it. But it's already been, you know, partially cooked and then it's been smoked.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're home free, but just be careful not to overcook it.
Okay, that's a great idea.
And I think that idea can be stretched. You know, you can vary that in a lot of ways in terms of the mixture that you cook it in. It doesn't have to be fat. It could be, you know, it could be chipotle and adobo and orange juice and a ton of garlic and, you know, water or broth or wine.
Right.
You see, and then go to the smoker and then go to the glaze. But you could do it with anything, chicken, whatever. But I think pork shoulder, I'm with you. I think that's a great piece of meat.
It's really hard to beat.
Yeah. Hey, I think this is a great idea. Give it a shot. It's going to work. It's going to be dynamite.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
You enjoy.
All right.
Bye, Kent.
Bye.
There are cuts that are so forgiving that you really can't kill them short of overcooking them to death. And that is anything from the shoulder, pork shoulder, chuck roast, that kind of thing. You're home free. Just don't let it get overcooked and you're done. Keep it real low. Anyway, 800-537-5252 or connect with us on Facebook. Mary's on the line from Fort Worth, Texas. Mary, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a niece that is going to study abroad in Spain.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to get her a cookbook that would give her some background on the regional cooking and areas and history of how dishes came to be and food and wines and so forth. But I didn't want it to be overwhelming for her. She's not an accomplished cook, and she probably won't be dining in fine restaurants.
I understand, yeah. She's bright and she's curious. She doesn't necessarily live and breathe food, and she doesn't have a ton of money.
Right.
All right. There's a couple of authors that come to mind. One of the people who has – she's written quite a few books on Spanish food. Her name is Penelope Casas. I think it's C-A-S-A-S. And she has done books on regional food. She's done books that include history. She's very serious about the subject, and she's deeply knowledgeable about it. So that would be one person to think about.
And
another person is the chef who is in Washington, and he does a television show on Spain. His name is Jose Andres, and it's A-N-D-R-E-S. And Jose has done one or two books. His recipes are incredibly simple. He talks about the heritage and the people. This is a man, he's so charismatic. And I don't think he goes into the depth and the detail that Penelope Casas goes into, because I think his books have been meant to be accompanying his television series, you know, mm-hmm. where you're seeing him. But it's a very welcoming, loving way for her to be introduced.
Mm-hmm. And, well, sounds like she might enjoy both of them.
They're two extremes in a way, and they might very much complement each other for her.
Wonderful.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate this so much.
Well, thank you, Mary. It's been our pleasure.
Thank you.
You have a very lucky niece. Thank you.
I think so, too. She's a delightful girl, and we're so very proud of her.
Well, you take care.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Well, Julie in Ohio has an interesting question. She says, when recipes call for mint, do they mean spearmint, peppermint, or does it matter? It really does matter, because peppermint can cancel out your ability to breathe and taste if it's really fresh. What they usually mean is spearmint, and recipe writers should say that. Spearmint is a gentle mint, and it has a sweet overtone to it. By the way, peppermint has its place, but it's really powerful, and used in the wrong place, it's just going to take over everything. So go for spearmint. And thanks, because this is the kind of question everyone should know the answer to. You can reach us on Facebook, you can reach us on Twitter, and you can reach us by email, splendidtable.org. Let's see. We've got Matt calling from Portland, Maine. Matt, what's up?
Hi there. My wife and I just moved, actually, from Portland, Oregon, here to Portland, Maine.
So this means you only have to change, what, the last little two letters on your return address?
Oh, yeah. If we could have found the same street to live on, we would have. It would have been great. Well, back in Portland, Oregon, we had access to some of, like, the best Asian markets of all time. It was great out there. We really incorporated, like, Japanese and Thai cooking into our, like, just regular weekly kitchen routines.
Right.
And now that we've moved out here, we are starting to see, like, everywhere, really interesting halal markets. And that's not something we're used to, and we're just wondering how should we incorporate this into our routine? Like, we just don't know, we really don't know anything about a halal market. We stepped into a couple of them, and we're pretty lost.
Well, essentially, you're in the world of one of the most sophisticated cultures, you know, on Earth. It's the Arab world. And what you're looking at, halal, it's interesting because halal means permitted. And harem, or harem, which we're familiar with in a different context, means forbidden or not considered to be allowed. So,
yeah.
And halal means pure. So what you're going to find is that, first of all, these markets are going to carry, obviously, Middle Eastern or Arab products. But there's an interesting thing about this is that there are additives that are generally not allowed. All the meats must be all the animals, the meats must meet their demise in a particular way. It's a lot like kosher meats in some ways. But what you're going to do now is you're going to start exploring all the Mediterranean foods.
Okay.
So you're going to find
fabulous beans and lentils, yogurts that'll be utterly delicious, spice blends. This is where you're going to start with the world of fava beans. Fava beans are incredible. Couscous. You know, welcome to Morocco. You're going to get your hands on Paula Wolford's new book, The Foods of Morocco. Okay. And you will lose your mind. These flavors, I mean, cinnamon, allspice, sweet paprika, fresh coriander together in a stew with small chunks of lamb and green olives and dried figs. Eggplant is going to rule. Things cooled with things like yogurt and mint and cucumber. So this is the direction you're going to go into now. And the authors that can take you there are people like Claudia Roden and Paula Wolford.
Perfect.
Okay?
Okay.
Go out there and celebrate.
Will do.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Have a blast. Bye, Matt.
Bye.
Reach us, 800-537-5252. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter, and you can actually send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We have Ellen on the line from Norfolk, Virginia. Ellen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Yes, on the bottom of my wine rack is a dusty bottle that I've been transporting around for 14 years of Quinta do Infantado Vintage 1985 Port. Ooh. And I'm not a port drinker, and I don't even remember how I got it. And it's been sitting there getting dusty. I've been wondering what to do with it. I don't know if I'll like it when I open it. It's been a little intimidating. So I decided that I wanted to have a port-based dinner for my friends, and we can all try it, hoping that it's good. I've taken good care of it.
Okay. Well, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to stand it up about 3 or 4 days before the dinner because it's going to have to settle.
Okay.
And you don't want to do that the last minute because you'll have a lot of sediment.
Got it.
Now, say the name again.
Quinta do Infantado.
Does it say Tawny Port? Does it say?
It just says vintage 1985 estate bottled.
Okay. My port vintages are a little weak, so I'm not sure if that was a good vintage or not. But usually when a vintage is declared in port, it's exceptional wine.
Yes.
We don't know how sweet it's going to be, but the first thing that comes to mind whenever I think of port is a meat that has richness behind it. And I'm thinking slow-roasted pork butt.
Okay.
Which is a cut from the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And you might want to, I mean, I would baste it with some red wine. I'd keep it pretty simple. I would do it with, you know, stuff some slits, make slits in it, and put in maybe some garlic and fresh herbs. Thyme or rosemary would be good in there. And maybe a little lemon peel or orange peel is really nice.
Mm-hmm.
Salt and pepper it. Do a slow roast, 325, until it's about 150 to 160 degrees at its center. And then you let it – and baste it. Keep basting it with its own pan juices. You want something, to put it bluntly, that has a bit of fat to it, because if the port is intensely sweet – It's going to need something like that to meet up with.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you want to do, what you want to have with that is maybe something that's very fresh. Like you know, if asparagus are in season where you are, asparagus and port aren't going to work. Green beans and port will probably work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the thing you also want to have is, because one of the great things to have with a vintage port, and it's a very traditional dessert, is to have nuts for cracking, you know, like walnuts and pecans and that kind of thing, and really good dried fruits.
Okay.
So dried pears and dried nectarines and peaches and prunes and that apricots for a little, you know, sort of snip. And the other thing you might really enjoy with the port is a great blue cheese.
Okay. I hadn't read that.
Yeah. And because, again, it's that sweet against salt. So it may turn out I'd have a wine as a backup for the main part of your meal, just in case the port is deeply sweet and it's too much with the pork. Okay? Now, if you want to go in a different direction, you could do roast chicken with it.
Okay.
Which is leaner, not as fatty, but with that really crisp skin and the juicy meat could be really nice with the port as well.
Okay. Now, I know I've heard restaurants, port wine reduction.
This is not a port you cook with.
Don't waste the port.
Unless you have a case of it.
Yeah. No, just one bottle.
And there is a tradition from England. You can buy these things that have wheels. They're antiques. And they hold your wine or your port at the proper angle that you can just then tip this thing. It has like a little crank to gently pour but not get any of the sediment in the glass. Okay. So you never turn the bottle over all the way. And it's usually on wheels. And port is always, if I recall correctly, passed to people going from right to left. And we're going to get emails on this from historians who really know what they're talking about. But there is, you may want to look this up, there is a ritual around port that is very, very, very specific.
All right. Well, I would hate to buck with tradition.
You got it. You got it. Enjoy it. Enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Plato, who said, "Pepper is small in quantity and great in virtue." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head over to splendidtable.org to get information on everything you heard here today and so much more. Get registered for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. We send you a recipe for weeknight eating every week. This year, it's our 20th anniversary, and we're plotting. So get registered for Weeknight Kitchen, and we'll keep you up to date on our latest 20th anniversary offering. You can also listen to us whenever you like. Download our podcasts at our podcast network, infiniteguest.org. You'll find the Splendid Table there, of course, as well as a collection of other shows, including Big Appetites, a podcast with our very own Sally Swift and her friend Patty Hinnage. Find them at infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.